Thank you for listening to this presentation from the Coin Podcast Network. Here's another podcast you might want to check out right now.
We're here because Frank Gable murdered Michael Frank.
He collapsed and died before getting anyone's attention.
It's a travesty of justice, and the state of Oregon has fought to keep him in jail.
Did you see Frank Gable stab Michael Frankie?
No.
Relatively few carjackings turn into murders.
There's a killer out there somewhere. Don't let me get railroaded for this. That's all I want.
Just head to coin.com, iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcast to hear that story. From our studios in downtown Portland, Oregon, this is a Coin 6 digital exclusive.
Okay, so on today's Writer's Block podcast, we have Nancy Richardson Fisher. Very excited to have her on. Her new book, Speed of Falling Objects, that comes out October 1st of this year. And you have had quite the interesting life. We'll get to your books in just a moment, but I know you grew up on the East Coast, and you started out working as a writer for Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey Circus. How did that all come to be?
I did. So after college, I moved to Washington, D.C., and I interviewed for a job with Ringling Brothers. And they said in order to get the job, I needed to interview King Tusk. So they flew me to Ohio, and I got ready to meet this man, I assumed, King Tusk. But instead, it was an elephant. He was the largest traveling land mammal on the face of the earth. So I quote-unquote interviewed him, and I got the job, and I became the circus's traveling writer. So I went from city to city, and I wrote stories about performers who were from that city and placed those articles in the Sunday supplemental entertainment part of whatever newspaper was in whatever town I traveled to. And it was a super cool job. I learned how to write really quickly. I learned how to juggle and to walk a low wire. And the only negative of that job was seeing wild animals in captivity, which is super sad, and became one of the inspirations for my first young adult novel, which you can talk about later. But that became kind of my inspiration. So I left that job and became the senior campaign writer for the University of California, San Francisco. I wrote a lot of grants. It was a good skill to have, but not super exciting.
After the circus, right? Well, and I want to ask you about the circus writing, because when you said, so you've got your Cornell degree in your hand, and you're interviewing an elephant, like what exactly does that entail? Are you just kind of more creating a story at that point, I assume?
That was my first creative writing assignment, and it entailed ducking a lot because elephants sneeze, and King Tusk must have had a cold. Mm. So he actually sneezed a lot, and which is incredibly messy. But I stood around and I talked to his I'm sorry, your interview just went on my Facebook. So I ducked a lot and avoided his sneezing, wrote just a little creative piece. And they must have liked it because they hired me.
I love it. And so the stories that then you continued to write for them, because I know you said you learned to do all those things like juggling and walking the low wire. The stories that you would write, were they on the performers and not just the animals?
Yes, most of them were about performers.
Okay.
So if, for example, the teeterboard team learned a new trick and they were premiering it in Atlanta, I would write about that and submit it to the newspapers in Atlanta for a story.
Okay.
So I got to meet a lot of different performers who were incredible. They pass their skills through generations. They take really big risks in their acts, and they have such a pride in what they do, which was wonderful to watch and super fascinating.
Yeah. And I'm just, who knew that that was a job, the job you had? I mean, so interesting. But like you said, the animals in captivity part was rough. And yes, I do want to talk about your book that was partially inspired by that. But you were saying you moved to California and you took a not so exciting or interesting job after that, the grant writing job.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And you know, that was fulfilling in its own way because you're raising money for cancer centers and research. But I really always loved writing more creatively. Mm-hmm. And while I had that job, a friend of mine was working as an assistant to an editor at Hyperion Publishing. And they had just acquired Bella Caroli's story. And Bella Caroli is the famous gymnastic coach who trained Nadia Comaneci, mm-hmm. and came to the United States, defected from his country and came to the United States. And my friend said, we have this pile of proposals from different writers who want to help Bella write his autobiography, to co-write it. Why don't you write a proposal and put it in the pile? And I had no idea how to write a proposal, but I ran to the library and I looked up a lot of things about Bella, and I wrote a proposal. And he actually read my proposal, called me out of the blue, and invited me to his ranch. So I flew to Houston, and Bella and his wife Marta picked me up from the airport, and we drove to his ranch, and we spent the weekend playing on the ranch, riding around on ATVs and playing with the animals. And he has just so many animals. It was unbelievable. And at the end of the weekend, he took me to the airport and I said, hey, we haven't talked about this book. What do you think? And he said, I had the job. At which point I said, I really like you and I don't think you should hire me because I have no idea how to write your story. Mm-hmm. And he told me about when he was a gymnastic coach in Romania, he would travel from elementary school to elementary school, and he would have the kids do cartwheels and somersaults, and he would choose children he thought were gifted. And he was at one school, and there was a little girl who wasn't that gifted, but she was jumping up and down to get his attention, and he chose her. And that little girl ended up being Nadia Comaneci. And the reason he chose her was because he knew she would try harder than all the other kids. So he said, I'm giving you this job because I know that you're going to try harder than any of those other writers whose proposals I received.
Wow, you're Nadia Comaneci in this story, then, pretty much.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And it was really incredible. And the other thing he told me that I've remembered my whole life is that when he chooses a gymnast to train, he never tries to make that gymnast into another Nadia. He always lets people be who they are. So Mary Lou Retton, mm-hmm. he knew she wasn't built like Nadia, didn't have the skills that Nadia had. He let her be the best gymnast she could be. And it was this great lesson that you should never try and copy anyone else because you'll never shine as bright. Mm-hmm. And I always remember that in my writing. I never try and write when anyone else is writing. I never try and behave or dress or do anything that anyone else is doing. I try to be as unique as possible, to just be myself.
Yeah, no, that is such good advice. And I would think that writing an autobiography for someone or biography would be difficult. I mean, as opposed to creative writing, it's a whole other art form. But it sounds like you had a lot of success with it because this led to other sports autobiographies on some big names as well.
It did. I ended up doing Monica Seles' story after she was stabbed on the tennis court by a fan of Steffi Graf. And I wrote Julie Crone's book. She was the winningest female jockey of all time. And Shannon Miller, the gymnast, and Nadia Comaneci's and Apollo Ono's. And I think the key to writing someone else's story is spending a lot of time with them, picking up kind of their turns of phrases and language, reading books that they read. Whenever I would do one of these books, I would go and live with that athlete in their home, usually for, well, with Bella, all told, it was probably several months' time. Hmm. And with the other athletes, I'd visit, I'd leave, I'd go back, and we'd spend just a ton of time together, doing whatever they did. So if they would wake up at 4:30 in the morning to train, I'd get up and work out with them. I would do whatever they did. If they were traveling to the ESPY Awards or a different event, I would travel with them. So It actually, it is a skill, but it's a really fun skill to learn because you kind of become them and you try and think like them, which is really fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. I would imagine, and you don't need to name names, but I would imagine that some are probably more interesting than others, or some were easier to write about than others as far as getting in their head or even just their life experience.
Definitely. The athletes who are a little bit older are more interesting just mm-hmm. because they have more life experience. So Bella had so many fascinating stories about, he told me a story about hunting with Ceausescu and how Ceausescu was the only person who was allowed to shoot a bear. That was the big prize. And beaters would come through the forest with clubs and beat the underbrush to force all the animals in front of them. And Ceausescu would be waiting with his rifle to shoot the animals as they came out of the brush. And Bella told this story where he was far away from Ceausescu, and at the bottom of a ravine and up the other side was a forest ranger who was asleep against a tree. And Bella saw a bear approaching the forest ranger, and he wanted to shoot the bear to save the ranger.
Yeah.
And he couldn't shoot the bear because that was Ceausescu's shot, and he literally would be imprisoned if he killed a bear on mm-hmm. Ceausescu's hunt. And ultimately, the forest ranger woke up and the bear mauled him to death. And Bella watched that. And the only reason he didn't shoot the bear was because he was terrified that he would go to prison. He had a wife. He had a daughter. So he couldn't do it. And stories like that, you're not going to get from a 17-year-old athlete.
No, probably.
You know,
not.
So
for
the
most
older
people,
they
but,
were, yeah, yeah, the more interesting they
yeah.
were.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And it's somewhere in there, I don't know if it was before or after, you worked for Lucasfilm, too. What were you doing for Lucasfilm?
I did. I was lucky enough to meet the woman who was in charge of all of the Star Wars books, both adult and children. And I met her because the same friend who had suggested I write a proposal for Bella introduced me to her because Hyperion was doing some Grateful Dead comics mm-hmm. with Dark Horse Comics and Lucasfilm. So when I met this woman, Lucy Wilson, I said, I love Star Wars. I love the universe. Can I write for you on spec? Meaning anything you have an idea about, I'll write a chapter or two for free. So I did that for about a year and a half and then was fortunate enough to get a middle grade trilogy. And so my main character was Anakin Solo, who's the mm-hmm. son of Han and Leia in the adult books. And he goes to a Jedi Academy and learns how to become a Jedi. And I got to write a trilogy that was within the Star Wars universe, which was incredibly fun.
That is so crazy because I know those types of books. My daughters have read those types of books over the years. And I've talked to other authors who've written similar things. And I've said I always thought that those were like machine generated, you know, from the Disney machine or the Lucas machine. I'm sure
right.
you had certain parameters you had to stay within for the story. I mean, you couldn't kill off Anakin, obviously.
Right.
You couldn't do anything too
right.
crazy, right?
No, I couldn't kill Anakin, and I needed to. I could create different creatures, but everything had to be. I couldn't create different planets. I had to stay within the confines of kind of the existing world.
Mm.
And they have tons of editors to go over and make sure that you have remained within the universe.
Okay, yeah. And now, I mean, there are all these spinoffs of Star Wars. There's some that are coming to one of the streaming services, too. Maybe it's their own streaming service, the Disney one.
Right.
Is there ever hope that, you know, maybe one of your trilogies, one of your stories would end up in one of these films or you know, for the big screen or the small screen?
Of course, I would love that. And there's always a chance that that could happen. So that would be unbelievable. I think a lot of writers, at least writers I know, envision their whatever they're writing as a film or a movie as a way to kind of, as part of the creative process. Mm-hmm. And I know, especially with the young adult fiction I write, a lot of times I'll even write it as a screenplay first, a story mm-hmm. as a screenplay, because screenplays are, they're the spine of a novel. They're, you're disseminating everything down to 110 or 120 pages. So you really get to see the arc of your story. So I think all of us probably hope for a movie or a Netflix or an Amazon show out of anything that we write. But Star Wars would probably be a good possibility.
Yeah, yeah. It's yeah, definitely life goals right there.
Yeah, so, exactly.
So you were doing that. You were doing the sports autobiographies. When did you make the move to the Northwest? I know you live in Hood River, and decide you wanted to break out and write novels.
Well, all along the course of my career, I've always tried to write novels. I think I realized that the young adult novel was my very useful niche for me, because I love the idea about writing a story that's incredibly about a time of life that's incredibly fresh and new. So when I moved to Hood River, which was, I don't know, sometime during the time frame while I was writing sport autobiographies, I tried my hand at writing a young adult novel, and I self-published it. It was called Pandora's Key, and it was the idea was that there was a fifth fury in Pandora's box, and that the descendants of the original Pandora, unbeknownst to them, were supposed to guard that box and make sure that that fury wasn't released. So I self-published that, and it actually did really well in its category. It got to number 4 on Amazon, and I thought, okay, I think I have a shot of really doing this. So I went back to my time at Ringling Brothers and used the inspiration that I had of wanting to shine a light on wild animals in captivity, and thought, what kind of story could I write that would incorporate that? Because there was a time when I was at Ringling Brothers where I led a journalist through the backstage area of Ringling Brothers. And we walked by these 18 elephants in a row who were shackled by one leg, and they were swaying. And the journalist said to me, why are they swaying? And I said exactly what I had heard everyone else say around me. They love the music.
Mm-hmm.
And I went home, and I knew that that was a big lie and that these elephants were really going crazy. And this was a horrible thing to do to a beautiful animal. So when I decided to write When Elephants Fly, which was my first traditionally published young adult novel, it was published by HarperCollins Inkyard Press last year, I took that inspiration and the other inspiration, which was, I have a friend whose mom has a mental health condition, and I watched my friend struggle with that, because when a parent has a mental health condition, their child has up to a 10% chance of also having some sort of mental health issue.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to live with that hanging over your head, 10% might not seem like a lot to if you're leaving a tip for a waitress, 10% is low. But when it's your life,
yeah,
10% is a huge number. And so I wanted to tell a universal story about living in the moment despite whatever fear is hanging over your head. For my friend, she decided to live in the moment. She went to college. She pursued a career. She married. She had a child. She's doing great. But she could have stopped and tried to live a really careful life, which isn't really living at all. So When Elephants Fly is about a young woman named Lily who has an overwhelming family history of mental health conditions. And she's trying to live a really stress-free life to avoid triggering schizophrenia, which is the condition that affected her mother. But when she witnesses a mother elephant at a zoo giving birth to a calf and then violently rejecting her calf in much the same way that Lily's mother violently rejected her, she becomes the calf's caretaker and ultimately goes on this desperate road trip to save the calf's life, meanwhile risking her freedom and her sanity and a first love. In order to fight for something bigger than herself and live in the moment.
Wow. I mean, that's I love how you drew inspiration from several parts of your life to come up with that. And did, I'm assuming that did really well, that novel.
It's done well. And just as a coincidence, today it's a 99-cent ebook deal on Amazon. So it's doing even better today.
Well, yeah, and this podcast drops next week. So hopefully it will be still a good deal.
Hopefully it'll be number one next week. But,
yeah.
No, it's done really well. And the coolest thing about it is that I get all of these emails from both young adults and adults. Because actually, in the young adult world, actually 75% of my audience is adult women. But I'm getting all these emails from either adult women or from teens saying, wow, this book really inspired me. And, mm-hmm. you know, my mom is bipolar or my dad has this condition or that condition, or I'm suffering from depression. And this is really inspiring me to figure out a way to find something worth fighting for mm-hmm. and to live in the moment.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because mental health is impacting so many people, you know, around the country and the world. So I can imagine it's really hitting a nerve with a lot of people.
Definitely. And, you know, the other part of that is that wild elephants will be extinct in the next 20 years
mm-hmm.
in the wild. You won't see any anymore. And there's no coming back from that. So I'm hoping that the resources I've provided in the back of the book and the story, because I think, you know, we all can say we care about elephants, but when you read a story that hits you emotionally, I think you'll care more and hopefully become a part of doing something to save elephants from extinction.
Yeah, yeah. Now, The Speed of Falling Objects, that's your newest work, novel, that comes out in October, first week of October, right?
Exactly, yeah. And that story is about a timid 17-year-old named Danger Danielle Warren. Her nickname's Danny. And she defines herself as defective and inferior because of a childhood accident where she lost one of her eyes and because of her mom's bitterness and her parents' divorce and her dad's abandonment. And she gets a call out of the blue from her father, who's a famous TV survivalist named Cougar. And he invites her to be part of an episode that's going to be filmed in the Amazon rainforest and is going to feature Gus Price, who's a famous teen movie star. And so Danny jumps at the chance to be part of the episode, but more to prove to her father that she's worthy of his love.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, their plane crashes in the Amazon, and some people survive, some people are injured, and Danny has to face everything that terrifies her, including learning a secret about the father she idolizes. And she has to find her unique skills and the strength to save herself and the people she loves and find a way home.
Yeah, it sounds amazing. Now, where did you draw inspiration from for this novel?
Well, first of all, I'm obsessed with survival stories.
Mm-hmm.
So stories like Touching the Void, where mountaineers are injured and have to crawl up a mountain, or Shackleton's Expedition. I'm also obsessed with Naked and Afraid, the television show, where there's one man and one woman who are dropped into horrible environments, swamps and deserts and forests, and have to survive with one thing like a fire starter or a machete, and their clothes are taken away, but that's kind of just the hook for the show. And I think that you get to see who people really are when they're stressed to that degree, whether in the stories I loved or that TV show. So I wanted to create a character, put her in a really challenging environment. There are 3,600 species of spiders, 2.5 million insects, 17 types of venomous snakes in the Amazon. So I thought, perfect location to put a character and have her discover who she truly is and who the people around her are at the same time. And the other inspiration for The Speed of Falling Objects was the idea that we create an idea of who we are based on our childhood experiences, through the stories we're told, the memories we have, but also misperceptions and lies. And we carry that definition of ourselves into adulthood unless we have the opportunity to challenge who we thought we were mm-hmm. and discover our true self. So I wanted to create this story that would make people question their own definition of themselves and encourage them to take control of their own narrative. Because the things that we're told, for example, I was told that I was intellectually lazy as a child.
Wow. Okay.
And I believed that. I really believed that through my whole life. But instead of carrying that into my career and adulthood, every day I define myself as not intellectually lazy by the choices that I make. And I've taken control of my narrative and defined who I really am. Or, I have a dodgy back and sometimes my back goes out. I've had ruptured discs and I've had doctors say you should play it safe and don't do any sports that are, at all dangerous or difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I kite surf in big waves. I mountain bike. I ski in the backcountry because I choose to define myself.
Right.
And so that's a huge inspiration for this novel.
Okay. Yeah. Well, and just proving people, listening to you talk, growing up, my parents would say to me, well, you just don't seem serious enough to be a journalist. You just don't have that kind of personality. And so that just gave me more drive to do it, to show them, no, I can be serious. I can be, I'm not always silly and not some flighty little girl. So yeah, I can relate to that. And I think a lot of people can relate to that as well. Just, having people tell them they can't do something and setting out to prove that they can.
Yeah, it's so easy to just accept the labels that you're given. And it takes real effort to go after what you want despite those labels.
Yeah.
And so that's my hope. That's my hope for people is because a lot of times you grow up and you just don't even question anything. And I think young adult books in particular are so powerful because they reach readers at a time where they can ask those questions of themselves mm-hmm. and it can change the trajectory of their life.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And so now, again, this is coming out October 1st. Are you doing any local bookstore appearances or anything around the area?
I am, and thank you for asking. So on October 2nd, I'll be at Powell's. There's Cedar Hills Crossing in Beaverton.
I love that one.
And I do, too, and I'm doing an In Conversation with New York Times bestselling author Colleen Houck. And we're going to chat about our novels, do a little bit of a reading, answer some questions from each other, have a little audience Q&A, and there will also be treats. So I hope people will come and
even more
and
reason
take
to come.
Part.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Awesome.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I know it seems like every author I interview for this podcast is already working on their next thing or is about to release, like has another date for another release. Do you have your next novel already mapped out?
I do. It is actually on submission right now to mm-hmm. publishing houses, and it's called The Story Collector. And it's about estranged twins, Kat and Hugo. They're 18 years old, and the story starts on their 18th birthday. And Kat is this driven, goal-oriented young woman who's certain about life, and Hugo is a rudderless young guy who really spends most of his time attending music and art festivals. And so on the morning of their 18th birthday, Kat writes, "I am free," in her journal, and Hugo writes, "Lex won't win," and then Hugo attempts suicide.
Hmm.
And as he teeters between life and death, Kat learns that she was named by Hugo as his medical proxy, which means she's responsible for all his medical decisions, including whether or not to terminate life support. In addition, he left a suicide note and tickets to The Rising, which is a fire art and music festival in the desert in California. And so Kat's not sure what to do because she really doesn't know her brother. So she's convinced by her brother's girlfriend to go to The Rising to get to know her brother before she makes the decision of whether to terminate his life support. And once at The Rising, she has to face the past, her part in Hugo's life, in order to decide his future and have one of her own.
Wow. That's quite a story that you can. Your mind, I would not say you are intellectually lazy. Was that the term that they... I would say quite the opposite of that.
Well, Thank you. Thank you for that. So I'm hoping that someone wants that story. And if they do, it will hopefully be out in the next year, year and a half.
Oh, I'm sure they will. Yeah. And I'm sure we'll be continuing to see your name. And maybe like we said, maybe even one of these things will end up on the small screen or the big screen or one of the streaming services. You know, there's so many options these days. But your stories, I could just picture all of them, you know, coming to life on one of those forums.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. And, you know, I also wanted to mention that for the next week on Goodreads.com, they're giving away 50 copies of The Speed of Falling Objects. So all people need to do is hop onto Goodreads and enter.
Oh, awesome. Okay. That's a good tip there. So yeah, again, this podcast drops next week. So hopefully the timing will all work out, but
maybe there'll be a day there.
Yeah. A day or so. Yeah. Well, Nancy Richardson Fisher, thank you so much for joining us. You are just fascinating. I just love how all over the place your career has been and just so interesting from the beginning to the present.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me.
Yeah, thanks, Nancy.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to this presentation from the COIN Podcast Network. Here's another podcast you might want to check out right now.
Hi, I'm COIN 6 morning meteorologist Kelly Bayern. Weather plays a huge part in everything everyone does every day. That's why the COIN Digital team has launched a Your Weather podcast. Every other week, you can hear me and my special guests talk about how the weather in our area changes day to day, season to season, and year to year, and what it means for anyone who likes or needs to spend time outside. Check it out on COIN.com under the podcast tab, or go to iTunes, Google Play, or Spotify and search COIN. If you like it, subscribe, rate, and review. We'd love to hear your feedback.
Thank you for listening to this presentation from the COIN Podcast Network. To hear more great podcasts, head to COIN.com, iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.